From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in England, March of the year 1616. William Shakespeare wanted to update his will shortly before turning 52 years old. Some historians view that as a sign that he knew his health was in decline, even though he wrote in his will that he was in perfect health. On April 23rd, just a month later, Shakespeare turned 52, and the cause of his death remains a mystery. But half a century later, John Ward, the vicar of Stratford, wrote about it in his notebook, writing, quote, "Shakespeare, Drayton, and Ben Jonson had a merry meeting, and it seems drank too hard, for Shakespeare died of a fever there contracted," end quote. Did a night of too much merriment kill Shakespeare? We might never know for sure. What we do know is that Shakespeare's legacy is immense. And 400 years exactly tomorrow after his death, there are a series of events in Rochester helping mark the occasion and helping celebrate the players, the community that celebrate Shakespeare locally. We got a lot to talk about this hour, so let me go ahead and welcome my guests, and I will go around the table. Dr. Greg Foran is here. Greg is an assistant professor of English at Nazareth College and wrote a dissertation focused on Macbeth in light of the 17th century religious and political controversies, and I actually can't wait to hear about it. I'm going to drag it out of Greg. Nice to see you, Greg. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also here is Christine Radarsky, Rochester City historian and co-curator of the Shakespeare in Rochester exhibit at the Central Library. Christine, welcome.
Thank you.
C.C. McFarland is here. Dr. McFarland's the director of All's Well That Ends Well for Shakespeare Players of Rochester. Nice to see you, C.C.
Thank you.
Also here is Virginia Monti, the co-owner of Wallbird Theater Company and director of this summer's production of Romeo and Juliet at the Highland Bowl. Virginia, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Peter Scribner, president of the Rochester Community Players, the RCP, and founder of the RCP's Shakespeare Players Program, co-curator of the Shakespeare in Rochester exhibit at the Central Library, and directing Hamlet at the Muck this fall. Peter, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Well, I asked our listeners on Twitter before the hour even began if they could think back to when they first encountered Shakespeare, almost certainly in their educational experience somewhere, and what their first impressions were. Here are some first impressions from our listeners. David says, first impression of Shakespeare, dang, can't we read something written in English? Ms. Garner writes online, in high school, my impression was, what the hell is this? Laura says, I loathed it due to an unimaginative teacher. Then I saw Macbeth with Glenda Jackson and Christopher Plummer. I've been addicted for life. Dr. Craig Seifer said, I had the opportunity to see Henry IV Part 1 live on stage at 14 years old before ever reading Shakespeare. Completely changed how I experienced it. Should be doing the same for all students. Get them experiencing the adventure on stage prior to reading. And Tyrone says, reading Julius Caesar at school left me bemused. If they'd shown me a decent Much Ado About Nothing, I may have gotten it earlier. And that, you know, that leads to the interesting question of, you know, how you connect with it. And I know it's sort of an age-old question by now, but I'll start with Greg. And I'm curious to know, Greg, because, well, first of all, I imagine you're still teaching Shakespeare, yes?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so when your students come into class, how much general idea of Shakespeare do they have?
They've gotten quite a bit, I think, from high school, mainly, maybe even as early as middle school. And they may have seen a production here or there, maybe a film, the Romeo and Juliet that came out in the 90s I think is still quite popular. But a lot of them express the same sentiment that it hasn't been presented well to them and they don't enjoy it. So my job is to make converts. And I think I do a pretty good job.
What do you find? Again, this is a very generalized question. There are some students who gravitate to Shakespeare right away, and others really need to find a way to sort of make things relevant to their own lives. But what are some of the techniques you use to try to get them to connect with the material?
I try to stress the joy in language that this man obviously had. And to get them to see that the sort of verbal exuberance, the multiple meanings are not a barrier to understanding. They actually enable you to make meaning. To give you an example, there's a little couplet from Cymbeline, one of his later plays. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust. Okay, there's a little pun there. Even the most, you know, well-heeled young man or woman is going to die, just like a chimney sweeper. But also, chimney sweepers do come to your house to dust. Okay, fine, a pun. But in the Warwickshire dialect that Shakespeare knew, a golden lad is a dandelion. little yellow flower. And when it turns white and blows away, that's a chimney sweeper. So here's a triple pun going on, and almost for no other reason than that he can do it and it's fun. And they should have that kind of fun with the language.
That's a great idea. When my wife and I were at the Globe in 2012, they had a rolling list of turns of phrase that first came from Shakespeare. And,
right.
You know, I would hope that is also interesting to students, because cliches get so embedded in our language. But to think about a man who had a command of language and the creation of these turns of phrase, these clever ways of seeing things, you know, I find that absolutely inspiring. It made me, as a writer, want to never use a cliche again and think of new ways to say it. Did you ever kind of approach that with students like that?
I do dwell a bit about how Shakespeare speaks through us, whether we know it or not, in everyday phrases, one fell swoop from Macbeth. There's hundreds of others. I just watched a good YouTube video on this. I probably saw the same thing you did. We ventriloquize Shakespeare, and we don't even know it.
Well, let's kind of do things chronologically here. And listeners, if you want to weigh in and share your Shakespeare experience, whether it was something that took a while for you to fall in love with, or your thoughts about the way students might view Shakespeare in 2016, we'd love to hear from you. Tomorrow marks 400 years since his death, and you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I said to the group that came in here, this is a little dessert after a week of broccoli on the program, and it's great fun for me to have a chance to talk to people of such interesting perspectives on Shakespeare. But I want to work chronologically, because there's a lot coming up here. And so I'll let you guys kind of sort of guide this, but I think as soon as starting tomorrow, what's going on? Virginia?
Well, tomorrow is part of the fundraising events for the summer show. We are doing the complete works of William Shakespeare abridged over at Muck, which I'm looking forward to, just because that's a fun way, especially for someone who maybe doesn't think they like Shakespeare, to get a taste of what we jokingly call the love of Shakespeare. We're doing that event, and that also transfers over to an event at Knox at 4 o'clock, so Knox Cocktail Bar. So that should be fun.
All right, Knox Cocktail Bar at 4 o'clock, which is where?
Over at Village Gate.
Okay.
And that's, we're premiering the design elements for the summer show. We're going to have birthday cake, because it's not just his death day, but his birthday, and giving away birthday gifts as well to those who come. So that's a free part of the event. So we encourage people to stop by.
All right. So that's what's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. What else do we need to know here? Cece?
Tonight is the second to last performance of All's Well That Ends Well at Muck, which is 142 Atlantic, at 7:30. And we have another performance tomorrow night after the complete works of Shakespeare and the Knox event. Then you can come back over to Muck and see All's Well That Ends Well.
Okay, so tonight, tomorrow, a lot going on. Anything else that's rolling out this weekend to cover down? Peter?
Well, then on Sunday, we have the community-wide celebration of Shakespeare. This is going to be at the Lyric Theater, the new theater there on East Avenue, the corner of Prince Street. And it's co-hosted by our organization, the Rochester Community Players, and by Lyric Opera. And right now we have 20 different events that are going to take place during that presentation. It starts at 2 o'clock. It's a free event. Donations are accepted. I'll tell you one thing I'm looking forward to is that Lyric Opera itself is going to be doing two set pieces. One will be operatic pieces from Shakespeare operas, and the other will be Shakespeare on Broadway. And that's a wonderful additional element to the Shakespeare universe. So that's 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon.
All right, so that is a busy weekend ahead if you love Shakespeare, or if you want to sort of rediscover Shakespeare, a lot of opportunities to do that. You also have this exhibit, and I would love for Christine to kind of explain, Christine and Peter to explain this traveling exhibit and what it is and what you put together.
We actually have two exhibit pieces. One is an exhibit that is at the Central Library right now. It's in the Link Gallery on the lower level of the Bausch & Lomb building there. And it is an exhibit that showcases original materials from Shakespeare performances in Rochester, as well as materials from literary clubs that have analyzed Shakespeare. You know, it's really fascinating when you look at the way people have received Shakespeare here in Rochester, not only all over the world. And we we have a we've been trying to analyze that through this physical exhibit, and then we also have developed a traveling exhibit that will be at the event on Sunday and that will be available at other Shakespeare events throughout the rest of the year. And I want to mention that Peter and I were not the only ones involved in this exhibit. We actually had the historical researcher Amy Pepe from the library, who really spearheaded the work and the research that went into this. And we also had a wonderful intern, Mary Gage, a Nazareth College student. And they were really the ones who did the hard work putting this all together.
There's a lot of fun and sort of curious history, even involving the Booth family. Is that right, Christine?
That is true. Edwin Booth was one of the premier Shakespeare actors of the 19th century. He was known as the greatest Hamlet of the 19th century, some might even say of all time. And he performed in Rochester many, many times. He debuted here in Rochester at the Metropolitan Theater when he was only 24 years old in 1857. But perhaps his most notable appearance here in Rochester came in 1889 when he had a stroke backstage at the Lyceum Theater while playing Othello, or playing Iago in Othello. And the director at that point came out onto the stage and informed the audience that the world had probably heard for the last time the greatest actor who speaks the English language. Fortunately, that was a little premature, and he was back on stages here in Rochester that December. But that would be the last time he appeared in Rochester before his death in 1893. But something that a lot of people don't know is that his younger brother also performed in Rochester, John Wilkes Booth, who we, of course, know as the assassin of President Abraham Lincoln. But he appeared on stage in Rochester for a 10-day run in 1861 and performed here many times before that fateful day in April of 1865.
Boy, so much history. And before I grab our first phone call, Peter, why don't you tell us a little bit about the exhibit's co-curator and, you know, what you think will fire the imaginations of people who have a chance to see it.
As Christine said, there's been a great deal of history of Shakespeare coming to Rochester. All the greats from the 19th century came to our town. We're hoping that the exhibit will just be the beginning point. We would like to put together a full article in Rochester History Magazine on the subject. Charlotte Cushman, the first great American actress, came here in the 1850s. She also came here for her farewell tour in 1873. Edwin Booth, as Christine said, was here many times, greatest actor of the 19th century. The great Madame Modjeska, the great Polish actress, came to the United States at age 35, but she was so magnetic as an actress that she only went by one name, Modjeska. She came here many, many times. Lily Langtree came to Rochester. She was, of course, very, very famous. She was apparently a lousy Shakespeare actor. The newspaper just, they said you could not imagine a production that was worse than that.
Wow.
It was, but she was a very popular performer. The Lyceum Theater saw all the greats from 1888 through until it closed in 1934. Mrs. Fiske came here in her, late in her career, in her first Shakespeare production in The Merry Wives of Windsor. And then after the Lyceum closed, the Auditorium Theater became the centerpiece of Shakespeare in Rochester. And in the 1930s, we had over about a three-year period an amazing group of performances. Catherine Cornell came here in Romeo and Juliet. Maurice Evans came to Rochester after doing Richard II in New York. It was the first professional production of Richard II in 80 years. Took New York by storm, came to Rochester. The Lunts, Alfred Lunt, Lynn Fontaine, brought a rollicking production of The Taming of the Shrew to Rochester. Gielgud brought his Hamlet to Rochester. Maurice Evans came back twice as doing Hamlet at Rochester. The great Paul Robeson and his groundbreaking production of Othello in the 1940s was performed in Rochester. And our little community theater group, which has been continuously operating since 1925, in January of 1936, we put on our first little Shakespeare production over at the Old Playhouse in a production of Twelfth Night.
Wow. See, and so remind our listeners then where to go and how to check this all out here. Peter, Christine?
So to see the exhibit right now, they're at the Central Library of Rochester Monroe County at 115 South Avenue. It's on the lower level of the Bausch & Lomb building. That will be up until the end of April. And then this Sunday at the Lyceum Opera, you can see the traveling exhibit. And then the physical exhibit will go back up in the literature division of the library in the Rundle building in September and October.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. This is Mike in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Mike.
You asked, what a wonderful program, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
You asked earlier how some of your listeners were introduced to Shakespeare. And I think my way may be a bit novel. You are probably too young to remember a set of comic books called The Classics. When most comic books were a dime, classics were 15 cents. And they did a series of Shakespeare. I remember Julius Caesar. But what they did that made them readable to comic book age kids, it was in more modern-day English. I think when early readers, and I mean, you know, first through maybe fifth or sixth grade, encounter the older style English, it becomes extremely difficult for them to read. They become more concerned by the pronouncing the words, decoding and pronouncing the words, than they are about following the storyline. I think it's only when, as they mature, that the ability to follow the storyline in that older language is possible for them.
Mike, it's interesting. You know, we've had people on this program in the past debate in almost heated fashion whether Shakespeare requires updating and translation for kids these days. And so, Mike, thanks for the phone call. It's a set of interesting points. I want to start with Dr. Foran, who kind of, you flinched a little when I brought it up there. But, you know, do students ask you if you can, is there something you can do to make it so that I can understand it in modern language? Does that question come up?
There are plenty of internet resources that I'm sure my students use, and I'm okay with that. There's no fear Shakespeare side-by-side translation of the original text. And I think some of that's necessary. That's not a bad thing necessarily. As long as it doesn't end there, it's okay to begin there. There's a new generation of Shakespeare graphic novels that are available on the market, and that's fine too. I think Shakespeare would have approved of that.
You do?
Yeah. I think he was an entertainer first and foremost, and he wanted to tell a story.
But what you seem to be saying is, when you say as long as it doesn't end there, you know, for example, I'm a student in your class. I'm struggling with the material, some of the density of the language. I find a translation or an updated version of the language. I get the story, then I go back to the original material, and I'm more prepared for understanding where the story is going to be able to go, and then I can absorb it in its original language. Is that what you hope?
Yes, that's right. And I think watching a film version or seeing a performance has that same effect, acclimating you to the plot, to the characters, that these are human beings doing humanly interesting things that I should care about and do. And then let's go back to the language. And a kind of process of reverse translation can be useful. Okay, we can take two passages side by side, and now let's look at what is lost when you update, what nuances are gone. That's actually very useful for a teacher.
Yeah, very interesting. Anybody here find it vulgar to update or change the language at all? Virginia?
Well, it's interesting, actually, because a lot of my time is spent, I studied in the UK, and I was amazed that American actors particularly are so terrified of Shakespeare. They won't even audition sometimes because, oh my gosh, it's that thing I can't do. When really, Shakespeare gives you everything in the text. It's very, very available. But we've been doing it. I was interested to hear the caller talk about this comic strip series because Shakespeare has so completely permeated our culture in ways I think we don't even recognize. And not just our culture, but all over the world, you'll find snippets of it. And it's fascinating for me to see there are people who love Shakespeare who don't even know it yet. They just haven't heard it called Shakespeare yet. So it's an interesting dilemma of just that fear of the language, which actually, if you remember, it's a language of metaphors. It's a huge key to that. So, and it's a language we don't speak very often anymore. You know, we are very direct. I mean, social media and all that. We're very direct. We're very simple. So it is a more demanding language, but it's also a much more robust language for beings as much.
Peter, any concern about updating?
Well, the bottom line is that Shakespeare wasn't written to be read. Shakespeare was written to be performed. And so the worst way to be introduced to Shakespeare as a student is to try to read through it, because you can't visualize what it is that you're reading. So the best way to start Shakespeare is movies and live performances. Then you realize that this language is rich. It's not merely, you know, what it is. I find the modern translations boring and uninteresting. There's just no color. There's no taste. Like that little snippet that Gray gave at the beginning here. There's three or four shades of meaning just in two lines. How do you translate that into a modern language? I'd point out that there are some wonderful internet resources for teachers of Shakespeare, especially the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington. On their internet site, they have dozens and dozens, perhaps hundreds, of exercises that can be done. What should be done on the grade level, now Greg's on the college level and it's more of an academic approach, but on the grade level, you need to take Shakespeare by getting the kids out of their seats, on their feet, practicing, reading, doing exercises, having fun, trading Shakespearean insults. That's just one of many, many games. I don't want to get ahead of myself. That's one of the things we're going to be doing on Sunday
Way, we got to stop for 1 second. What's an example of one of the great Shakespearean insults, Peter?
Oh, Jesus. I don't. you caught me on there. But, there's dozens of them. Go ahead, Greg.
Greg?
I just finished Henry IV, Part 1 with my students about a month ago. Hal calls Falstaff a huge hill of flesh.
A huge hill of flesh.
It's a fat joke.
Yes. Shakespeare even started the "your mom is so fat" jokes. I mean, like, who knew that it all came all the way back from Falstaff? So
he also started the knock knock jokes. That's the porter in the Scottish play. As Macduff is banging on the door trying to get admission, and the drunk porter is saying, "Knock knock, who's there?" And off he goes.
All the things we didn't know are connected to Shakespeare, which was exactly Virginia's point that she's. We all love Shakespeare without knowing it. It's part of Virginia's point. Well, let me read a comment on Twitter then that will be a little biting for our panel then. Matt says, "I still have my Riverside Shakespeare from college. As a recovering English lit major, I care never to read the Bard again." Oh, how do you reach him? Peter, you look like someone stabbed you.
Oh, yeah, because it's funny. I have my college Shakespeare, and whenever I read a play again, like I've just reread Hamlet for our production this fall, I go back to my college text because I just get the feel of what it was like to first be introduced to Shakespeare back in that era. I have a feeling that that the comment came from somebody who had bad education inflicted upon him.
Cece, you're smiling. You agree with that?
I do. I think that Peter's point that these are plays. So they aren't meant to be just read. And a lit major was probably doing a lot of reading Shakespeare and probably not so much speaking it aloud or going to see it. And the meaning behind the words is all in the performance. So understanding what's being said comes from the actor, and that influences the person watching or listening to its understanding.
Well, sure. I mean, and to the point that Peter was making about teaching it, not necessarily even at the college level as Greg does, but as, you know, at younger grade levels. I recall just sitting in a desk. I recall Chaucer and Shakespeare and just sitting there reading it and not feeling connected to it and being told, go home and read some more of it and come back and now take a test on it.
I did a one-day class at the STEM Academy over at Edison, and all the students there were from Laos and Cambodia and Puerto Rico. There's a young lady from Africa there. None of them were native-born Americans. And for 42 minutes, they never sat down. They were on their feet as we did one exercise after another. They enjoyed it. They had a fantastic time. They started encouraging each other to pick up on the little things that we're hitting at. Shakespeare can be the best, most fun component of your high school and junior high school curriculum, if it can be taught that way.
I'd like to go back in time and have you come teach the class if I could, Peter. That would be just fine. Speaking of high school experience, this is Steve in Brighton up next. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, I just wanted to mention my experience when I was doing a Shakespeare class in high school. One of the things that saved me is that the library at my school had a full collection of the Shakespeare plays on record form. And what I did is I would read the book along with listening to the records. And that enhanced my experience with it like 10 times. Your comments earlier about seeing the performance is very important, but I would recommend students, if they can get a hold of audio copies and read along, it'll enhance their experience.
Steve, thanks for the phone call. And we're seeing a number of comments from listeners. Matt, first of all, follows up to say, yes, I had an awful professor. Yes, read 3 plays per week, used cassettes while reading to help bring it alive. It half helped. Contrast that with Brad, who just writes to the program and says, I read the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V and loved it immediately. I had a brilliant English lit prof in college. So that seems to be the baseline. If you're going to love it, you need someone who knows how to bring it alive for you. Denise and Webster taught this to 2nd to 5th graders, Denise?
Hi, yes.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
I can.
I just wanted to talk about my experience. I think high school is too late to introduce Shakespeare. I think it should be introduced in elementary school. We used to live in West Virginia, and I did an after-school theater program, and an entire semester was dedicated to Shakespeare with 2nd, 3rd, and 4th graders, and we did a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and it was one of the most exciting classes I ever taught, and children understood the language if it was presented in a really fun, active way.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Starting at 2nd to 5th grade, any opposition to that in the room here? Because again, that language is going to be really tough if you're in 2nd grade. But
just about every Shakespeare company in the United States has an educational component, and these components always include Shakespeare for elementary school kids, right up through master's classes for older high schools. So yeah, and I'm hoping that someday our organization will be able to do that as well.
Virginia?
Well, it's. I definitely think you can start, particularly with the storylines and the development, because these stories are so recognizable. How many kids have seen Disney movies, and how many of them, you show them Lion King, and then you say, this is Shakespeare, there you go. It's right there. But the fun of the language, I think, and I will say, I should not say this in a room full of Shakespeare fans, I am a convert from someone who loathed it to someone who couldn't get enough of it, because it wasn't till working at the Globe and having it beaten into me, and suddenly I realized everything worth knowing is actually between the lines. It's, the way it's set up on the page. It's the way the meter works. There's so many hidden gems. What I like about it is you start early and you keep coming back to it, because each time you come, there's something new to discover, to emerge from that text.
KB in Penfield writes to the program and says, relevant in high school? Absolutely. The rhythms and figures of speech are remarkable, and the wordplay, if explained properly, is fascinating. I thought so as a teenager. I still do. That said, I wish we'd start with Macbeth or Taming of the Shrew, which are far more likely to draw and maintain the interest of teenagers than Romeo and Juliet. That one just makes their eyes roll, in my experience. And for heaven's sake, if you're going to teach Romeo and Juliet, wherefore means why? KB and Penfield.
Thank you.
Is that an inside Shakespeare joke? I mean,
how many people think that it's, where are you, Romeo, when it's why are you, Romeo? And it's so much more meaningful that way.
Wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Yeah. Why are you, Romeo? Which is such, that's what she's asking. Why are you this man that
which
I cannot
have? Which is a much more interesting question,
yes,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, and if I can follow up to that, because I think I'm currently working on Romeo and Juliet, which has been a blast, because I came to it actually, again, with the, oh my God, not this show, everyone does this show, and then doing a closed reading of it. And one of the greatest stage directions of all time is actually embedded in this show, which is the moment Romeo sees, there's the very famous speech, to the pilgrim's hands, good pilgrim, you do wrong your hands too much. And reading it again, it hit me, and I don't know why it took so long to realize it's a shared sonnet. It's two people sharing this very emotional, heartfelt piece. And if there's not a better example of what true love is, then you first meet somebody and the first words you say to them is a perfect sonnet. I mean, that's great material right there. And it's not in the words itself, but in the way it lays on the page. I'm looking forward to doing Romeo and Juliet this summer just because I think there's so much in there people haven't seen because it's been on the paper so long. So,
well, on that note, let's get our only break of the hour. I'm going to come back. Margie in Brighton's been waiting to join the conversation. We'll keep going back to the phones and our listeners. We'll read more of your comments about Shakespeare one day away from the 400th anniversary of his death. His mysterious death. A lot is mysterious about Shakespeare. And by the way, Greg, we can answer a question. There was a common question in the room. How long will it be until we get a question about whether Shakespeare actually wrote this stuff? Took 19 minutes. We'll address that as well. And anything else you want to talk about Shakespeare related? So much going on. If you missed it, we will reset all of those things that are coming up tonight, tomorrow, Sunday, and all the way into the summer at the Rochester Public Library with our full panel of Shakespeare lovers from across our community. That's next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we sit down with the man who broke the Flint lead water story. Kurt Guyette's going to be in Rochester talking to students, and we're going to talk about the tenets of journalism, the work he did to help break that story, the impact it's having, and what he thinks about the state of modern newsrooms. That's Monday on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the YWCA, presenting the Stand Against Racism Breakfast, a panel event to discuss practices in reducing racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare, Friday, April 29th at 8 a.m. at the Riverside Convention Center. Tickets at ywcarochester.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and KB in Penfield thinks Romeo and Juliet is not a good start for high schoolers. And to each their own? It's cool, but Cece, among others in the room, were saying, Peter and Cece were like, wait a second, that is ideal for high schoolers, yes?
Yes, I do think it is. It's aside from the fact that it's about teenagers who fall instantly in love and kill themselves for each other. I mean, it's not a very good model for, yes, for teenagers, but the melodrama of first love and big fight scenes and of course the sex. I mean, what's not for teenagers to love in that if presented well?
Okay. Peter, you're saying the same, yeah?
Yeah, it's a nasty, horrible world that these kids are growing up in Romeo and Juliet. Gang-ridden violence, and this young love sprouts in the middle of it. There's nothing soft or eye-rolling about this play. It's exhausting.
Let me grab Jake's comment. Jake says, I've always loved the conspiracy theories around Shakespeare for creativity, if nothing else. Is there any weight to some of his works not being wholly his own, but from other authors as well? That's its own discussion for another hour, but it's a question a lot of people ask. It sounds like this panel, first of all, this panel is filled with Stratfordians. We don't have an Oxfordian on the panel, Jake, so you're not going to get an Edward de Vere or anybody else believer here. But Greg Foran wants to just weigh in briefly here because it does come up. I wonder even if your students ask you about it in class?
Oh, yeah. Yeah? Sure. Yep.
And what do you tell them?
Well, strictly speaking, several of the plays are products of collaboration. That was common in Renaissance theater. But Shakespeare collaborated with other Renaissance playwrights, not with noblemen hiding out somewhere who couldn't reveal themselves. And this, you know, this really wasn't even a question for the first 200 or so years after Shakespeare's death. And it becomes a question in the late 18th century, early 19th century. And I think it coincides with the rise of a romantic sensibility that privileges personal experience above all else. And you see that in someone like William Wordsworth, who makes himself the subject of his poetry. And that carries over today. Writers are told now, write what you know. I think of remember the James Fry controversy, A Million Little Pieces?
Of course.
He went on Oprah. He tried to sell that book as a novel and couldn't get a publisher. When he pitched it as a memoir, he could. We think that art has to come from somewhere deep inside. And there's some truth in that, but it really underestimates the power of the imagination. And that's what Shakespeare was so fascinated by, the power of the imagination to take a snippet of something you read or a conversation you had with somebody who may have just come back from Italy and to flesh that out into a story is what he was so good at. And so many of the plays dwell on the imagination's power. Macbeth, who can almost feel like he's killed the king before he's done it. Othello, who can conjure up infidelity out of the barest of evidence. A Midsummer Night's Dream is all about the power of the imagination to affect how we feel about ourselves and each other.
Is there something classist in the argument that someone from Shakespeare's background couldn't have had the experience to do that?
I think so. There's a sense that this should be a nobleman who is Oxford trained and who has traveled the continent. It just fits someone's idea of what Shakespeare should be. But he was the son of a glovemaker who was precociously intelligent and apparently a sponge for everything he read, heard, and saw.
Well, Jake, if you want the cinematic version of the Edward de Vere story, I think the movie was Anonymous with Rhys Ifans, and it portrays Shakespeare as a Philistine, barely literate, you know, philandering drunk. But Oxfordians believe that, and if you want to check that out, it's called Anonymous. Peter, you want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up a point that Peter Brook brought up in his recent book. On top of all the academic analysis of this issue is the fact that theater is so collaborative, and all of us who work in theater, you may be able to write a novel or a poem in splendid isolation, but as a playwright, you have to be there in the theater every day working with your actors, getting the feedback, getting the constant corrections, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, make those adjustments, make those cuts. Bring in new, and you have to do it quickly. You can't, send off a courier to some isolated palace and get so it's just absurd to think that Shakespeare was anybody other than a working dramatist.
Well, we have a city historian here. Historians are evidence-based fact lovers, but does the intrigue interest you at all, Christine?
It does interest me, but what interests me is that, to find Rochesterians debating this in the 19th century and realizing that what to many of us is an academic question was actually interesting, the lay population. I think today we tend to look at Shakespeare as highbrow, and we tend to forget that Shakespeare was popular culture in his day and in the 19th century.
Such an important
especially.
Point.
And we would have sort of your ordinary citizens here in Rochester debating Shakespeare and, whether he wrote it or not, the quality of the work, and critiquing it, too. One of the interesting things we have in our exhibit is a diary written by May Bragdon. We've borrowed it from the University of Rochester. May was the sister to Claude Bragdon, who we all know for building the Central Railroad Station in Rochester, but he also was involved in the theater in New York City. But May, at the time, was not necessarily well connected to the theater, but we find within her scrapbooks her comments within the program. And she would, next to the actors, make comments, old, funny, pretty, nervous, one that if I read it correctly, said terrible. And that was not at all unusual. Ordinary citizens who were going to the theater were feeling confident to critique and value that for what it was and how they were seeing it. And I think we've lost some of that today.
Just imagine 400 years from now, Big Bang Theory is going to be highbrow.
And they're
going to
say, right.
There's going to be some density. How do I get through Sheldon Cooper's language? I hope not. But that is a very important point. I mean, there was, it was a pop, I guess pop culture is a good way to describe it, of the time. I want to get back to the phones. Margie in Brighton, next up. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to just call a question.
Margie, if you're on a speakerphone, can you get off the speakerphone?
Yeah.
Just a little echoey. Go ahead.
Okay, I wanted to call attention to the fact that 100 years ago, Rochester marked the occasion of Shakespeare's 300th birthday by planting the Poets' Garden in Highland Park. And there will be a tour of that garden on Tuesday at 7 p.m. So another way of celebrating Shakespeare in Rochester is visiting the Poets' Garden.
All right, tell us again, where is that?
Highland Park.
In Highland Park. And when, Margie?
Tuesday at 7 p.m., Master Gardeners will be speaking about the Poets' Garden, which was planted and established in honor of Shakespeare's 300th birthday in 1916.
Yeah, the Poets' Garden is located immediately next to the Parks Department right headquarters right across from the Lambert.
Right.
Very good.
Well,
Margie, thanks for the phone call there. Should we know anything historically about that, Christine?
Well, 1916 was a really important year in our community. You know, as we're celebrating 400 years since Shakespeare's death now, they celebrated 300 years back in 1916. And, you know, speaking about community involvement and the way Shakespeare, you know, really affected the entire populace, this was one of the largest events in our community that the community had ever seen. They had 3 days in June where they put on this pageant in Exposition Park, which we know today as Edgerton Park. There were thousands and thousands of people who gathered there. There were 2,500 actors and dancers, a 1,000-voice chorus, a 250-piece band. It was just this huge celebration, you know, the spectacle of Shakespeare that our entire community came out for. And the Poets' Garden was just, what was Shakespeare Garden at the time, was just another example of what was happening here 100 years ago.
And of course, being Rochester, it rained.
Dennis in Pittsford next up. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yes, I was over in Italy touring and driving along the Autostrada, and just decided on a lark to go visit Verona. And, you know, it's a beautiful little town, and of course, the story of Romeo and Juliet is highlighted, and maybe from a historical standpoint, a little bit of a fanciful way there. You know, there's the House of Juliet, Casa di Giulietta, and a number of hotels and so forth built around that theme. But in reading about it, for example, Dante has a similar theme of stories, and including families called Fontecchi and Capaletti, who are the Italian names that are used for Romeo and Juliet's families. And I guess I wondered, one of the speakers on the panel did say that Shakespeare, you know, had contact from people returning, for example, from Italy. I wondered if it's true that Romeo and Juliet is, you know, the inspiration for it, or perhaps some of the plot was based on earlier folk tales of similar nature, and to what extent that might have played other plays of Shakespeare.
Shakespeare's only original plot is The Tempest. Every other play he wrote, he had borrowed plot points from things he had read or further back from folk tales that were just current in his society. And that's true of Romeo and Juliet as well.
To answer your question, Dennis?
Yes, it does. That's very interesting.
Yeah, thanks very much. So, The Tempest is the only one.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Peter?
But he would take a very simple story and then elaborate it and then pile on top of that and pile on top of that. You look at Hamlet and you look at the predecessor stories, and they're like nursery rhymes compared to the play he eventually created. So historical background especially on the non-history plays can be interesting. It can occasionally be insightful, but boy, the brilliance he brought to it just went far beyond whatever his predecessors did.
Okay. Virginia?
I was about to say, in terms of the historical element, something I always find fascinating is that we have to remember, A, there was no authorship the way we think of authorship, which we've already kind of brought up, but also there was no copyright. So oftentimes what these companies would do is, oh, you're showing a version of Hamlet. The Globe wants a version of Hamlet. Quick, Shakespeare, write us a version of Hamlet that is better than their version of Hamlet. So we can, and sometimes they'll even make fun of other versions that are running. And so that was a very common practice. And then you have, of course, the companies that go out of town and are traveling and they'll be rewriting. So these additions just keep kind of coming and keep, they were all about taking what was around them and trying to one-up the previous version. So it's very, very common during this time to that level of collaboration.
And also, Shakespeare was writing for a company, mm-hmm. So he was writing to the strengths of the people in the company that he was writing for. And so as the members of the company change, so does the content of the shows. So All's Well That Ends Well has three fools in it because he must have had three really good comedic actors. They're very different kinds of fools, but obviously he was writing for a certain set of people.
Denise, who had called in earlier, says she just wanted to follow up and say, I want to encourage people to not dismiss children and their ability to understand complex subjects and language. Children love good stories, and they love the feel of language in their mouths. They love the action, and they also love William Shakespeare's personal story and the history and culture of the times. Teaching stage combat to kids, brandishing homemade swords while wearing Elizabethan costume is a trip. Denise just sharing some of her thoughts there, and thumbs up, Denise. I've always thought, you know, don't underestimate kids and their ability to appreciate, not only love good storytelling, but to appreciate and absorb language, and to even pick up on it quickly and its usages. So it's a wonderful message. A couple more listener comments. Mark writes, let's see here, all this talk about Shakespeare's death and no talk about who stole his skull? So, who wants to tackle that one? I guess somebody stole the skull from the grave. Is that sort of the idea? Is that right?
There's a news report about that. Yeah, but so what?
Okay. Sorry, Mark. I mean, it's interesting. I had read that Shakespeare had some sort of admonishment to possible grave robbers on his grave. Is that lore? Or is that true?
That's true.
So he warned them. Not to steal or be cursed. So there you go. Amber writes to us and says, I fell in love with the poetry of Shakespeare when a brilliant man named James Yarra taught Twelfth Night to my ninth grade class. And Martha writes, I missed most of the humor reading Shakespeare. I had to hear it. Great discussion on Shakespeare. That's a great point. Sometimes, as we've said, the static nature of just reading it, it's hard to pick up on the nuance. But hearing it, humor comes forward. Cece, you agree with that?
I do. And I think part of it is the society that we're living in right now, that we've been taught that Shakespeare is highfalutin and hard to understand and very serious.
And self-serious.
Shakespeare
and self-regarding.
Is serious. Yeah. And it's not. I mean, some of the plays are, but some of the plays are not serious. And not every word of every line is important. And so hearing it, you can hear with the inflection, what gets thrown away, what's mm-hmm. funny, what means something else besides the words that are on the page. I mean, it really comes to life when you hear it.
What's the most deliciously funny of Shakespeare to you, Cece?
Oh. I can't answer that, actually. I don't have a favorite.
You don't have a single
funny.
Favorite? Anyone want to jump in with a favorite?
I like the tragedies better than the comedies,
okay.
Personally.
Virginia
so.
Monte?
If anyone has seen Shrew, the whole exchange with Petruchio and Kate is one of the funniest. Where does a bee doth wear his sting in his tail, in his tongue? Whose tongue? Yours if you talk of tails and so farewell. What with my tongue in your tail? I mean, it's a wonderful quip back and forth, and it's just so unexpectedly raunchy and witty at the same time, this whole very fast, very rapid wordplay. So, and it's just, it's embedded everywhere.
Well, we've got a few minutes left here. I want our listeners to know about the various things coming up here. We've been talking about Shakespeare because tomorrow marks 400 years since the death of William Shakespeare, and our various panelists from around our community are sharing with us all the things that are going on. So I'll start with Dr. McFarland. Cece, tonight, what's going on?
Tonight, All's Well That Ends Well at Muck. That's tomorrow night too, 7:30 both nights. And Muck is located at 142 Atlantic Avenue. And I think the website is www.muccc.org.
All right, Virginia Monte.
We have, as part of the Birthday Bash fundraiser, we have The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged, which is all 37 plays in 97 minutes by three actors. And then we'll lead into the event at Knox Cocktail Bar. And all of this is for the fundraising for the production of Romeo and Juliet that will be at the Highland Bowl, which is a massive undertaking designed after actually modern-day anime and video game themes.
Wow. Okay. And the event that you're talking about, by the way, is mm-hmm. tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yes.
Okay.
At 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock. Peter and Christine, just a brief note on what people can check out when it comes to Shakespeare in Rochester. Christine?
The exhibit at the Central Library will be open through the end of April, and you can also learn more about the history during a traveling exhibit at the Lyric Theater on Sunday as part of the birthday bash that Peter can tell you more about.
Yeah, and we're also hoping to put together an article. It'll probably be out within a year. There'll probably be more live presentations about Shakespeare in Rochester as well. It's just a great subject. And then finally, if I may, Sunday, 2 o'clock, the community-wide celebration. Our 2016 equivalent of the 1916 pageant. We won't have 2,500 presenters. It'll be more modest, but it also will be indoors, so it doesn't matter if it rains. I should have mentioned Bernard Plansky. He's a medical doctor. He's a colleague of ours who's working with me on this. Bernard works with traumatized veterans, using Shakespeare as a way of getting them out of their shell. He's also this past year he worked with through the Hillside Center with a group of inner city kids using Shakespeare, and Rappin' Dr. P will be doing his presentation at the event on Sunday, as well as bringing up some of his veterans to do a presentation.
Very good. And if you see Hamlet at the Muck this fall, Peter will be directing. So last comment, I've got 45 seconds. Greg Forn, you want to jump in? Go ahead, Greg.
I just want to say, direct your audience to ShakespeareInRochester.com, a website where we're collating all the events from this year in Rochester in one place. Check that out. One of those will be a production of Midsummer Night's Dream at Nazareth College this fall.
ShakespeareInRochester.com. Tom on Twitter says, Shakespeare, mostly taught badly in schools. and what we're finding is that may be true, but when it's taught well, you can cultivate a love for a lifetime. So my last question to Greg is, who teaches it at the college level? If you don't love Shakespeare and you don't have the fire for it, should you not teach it at all? Do you do a disservice to Shakespeare if you teach it badly?
There's a danger of that. There was an article in, I believe it was Salon.com earlier this year, a high school teacher writing to say that he has replaced Hamlet with cereal to good effect.
Wow. Well, I will say I am thankful not only for the work in the community that we've been hearing about from the people who've been on this panel, but for the people who have the fire for Shakespeare to teach it beautifully. So, Greg, congratulations to you on that and continued good work at Nazareth College. Greg Foran teaches it there. Peter Scribner is the guy I said I wish you'd go back in time and teach my high school class, president of the Rochester Community Players, among other things. Great talking to you, Peter. Thank you for being here. CeCe McFarland, Dr. McFarland's directing All's Well That Ends Well that you can go see tonight. Nice seeing you here, CeCe. Christine Radarsky, Rochester City historian, co-curator of Shakespeare in Rochester. Great seeing you as well. Virginia Monti, co-owner of Walbird Theater Co., directing this summer's Romeo and Juliet. Great seeing you. John Andrus, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely weekend. We'll talk with you Monday.